Welcome back to Under the Same Sky. A podcast that aims to broadcast content related to interculturality, diversity, multicultural education, inclusivity, and equity. This is a podcast offered by the International Association for Intercultural Education with the participation of different collaborators. Today, Domiziana Turcati and Dr. Marta Montero Siburd speak about the most salient work and legacy of Brazilian educator and philosopher Paulo Freire and Dr. Montero Siburd's personal reflections about him. Dr. Marta Montero Siburd is a multi-cross and intercultural comparative educator, lecturer in social sciences at Amsterdam University College, former visiting fellow at the Institute for Migration and Ethnic Studies of the Social Science Faculty at the University of Amsterdam, and she became professor emeritus from the University of Massachusetts in Boston when she migrated to the Netherlands. Her work and passion has focused widely on Latino population in diverse contexts: American urban schooling, bilingualism, and curriculum development in Latin America, and she has worked with Turkish Dutch and Moroccan Dutch youth through the research in schools and community ethnography. Dr. Montero Siburd's fervent support towards Paulo's greatest work has influenced her teachings, not only for the importance of his work, but also because of her personal relationship to him. Domiziana Turcati is a Doctor in Philosophy candidate in Migration Studies at the University of Oxford. Domiziana has been the student and mentee of Dr. Montero Siburd since her undergraduate studies at the Amsterdam University College. This helped Domiziana to proceed into a Master's in Philosophy at the University of Cambridge and to incorporate Freire's thoughts into her research with migrant communities. Welcome, and we hope you enjoy it.
Well, good afternoon, Maestra. How are you? How are you feeling about being here today and talk about Paulo Freire?
Well, I'm very excited, especially because it's been 23 years since his death and 50 years since the publication of the Pedagogy of the Oppressed. So it is a wonderful moment to remember him and recall him, especially during these times.
Well, Maestra, for me, it's also very special to be doing this with you because I know you've been incorporating Paulo Freire's ideas in your teachings and you've tried to talk me about Paulo Freire, and it's thanks to you that I know of him and I learned how to incorporate some of his ideas in my research and in my own life. So it's very special for me to do this with you, and I would really like to thank you. And so the first question that I would like to ask you is, when did you come across Paulo Freire and his teachings? When was this? When did it happen?
Well, I was living in Mexico City in the 1970s, and I had the opportunity to be at the university at the time. And among the students, they shared, my Mexican counterparts shared with me, La Pedagogía del Oprimido, the Pedagogy of the Oppressed. And I was so delighted because my anthropology professor had said, yes, you must read it. It has marked me for life. So I read it from page to page. I was studying anthropology, and it resonated with me because I could see that what he talked about, those who are oppressed and the oppressor, how they have a symbiotic relationship and it is maintained. You could see it reflected in the poor on the streets, the woman who would be selling their toys, whatever artifacts they had, their arts, their crafts, with children hanging all around them in order to feed them, or the man who was begging on the street with tattered clothes. So you saw the reality of poverty stark naked in your face, and you realize, yes, there must be a way that this can be overcome. So for me, it was also a time of heyday because I was near to CDOC, which is the Center for Intercultural Center for Documentation in Cuernavaca, and it had been founded by Ivan Illich, a former priest who was very radical in his school, in his thinking. He actually published a book on deschooling education, And he had been able to get people like Paulo Freire to come and lecture there, Eric Fromm, who was doing studies of in Mexico and writing, Michael Maccabee, who had been also doing psychological studies, Santiago Ramirez, all of these intellectuals, and even, you know, there is talk that not only intellectuals from the US were there, but intellectuals from all over the world. So it was a wonderful time to be receiving the kind of thinking that was not simply surface level thinking, but thinking that inculcated in me the sense of looking beyond the surface level into the deeper levels. So armed with that kind of thinking, I actually became militant and I began to do protests, student protests, and I would march and I would actually became very adamant about women's rights. And one of the things I fought most and I continue to fight against is machismo in Mexico. So those were the reasons I was all excited. And then I left Mexico in the mid 1970s to go to teach, to learn actually, to finish a doctorate in the United States, because I could continue to live in Mexico, but to further my studies, I wanted to be able to go. I was on the waiting list at Harvard, and then Boston University gave me an incredible grant in bilingual education. So I decided to pursue that. And when I got to Boston, I again reread The Pedagogy of the Oppressed. And luckily enough, I was there at a time when professors like Henry Giroux, who became my supervisor for the doctorate, was there. Peter McLaren was often visiting, Stanley Arona. So Ira Shore came, and you had Chomsky as well. So you had this radical revolutionary sense also thriving in Boston, Massachusetts. What I learned from Freire was, in bilingual education, which stands with me to this day, is first of all, that there is an implicit relationship between the ideologies of language related to power. In other words, you're not simply speaking a language, you are carrying an ideology of that language and the power strata that it carries with it. Secondly, that there was no need to suppress your language, your native language, whether it's Spanish or Criollo, because in post-colonial or dominant societies, the idea is that you had to give way to a dominant language in order to become somebody. But this was something that Freire taught us, that in countries like Tanzania, Guinea-Bissau, the countries that he worked in with this illiteracy campaign, trying to help illiterates become literate, that the issue of taking the language of the oppressor was the same thing as chaining yourself in the language system. So I learned to appreciate the value of speaking Spanish and actually decided that I would publish in Spanish even while at Harvard, which was not allowed at that time. So these were ways that one could rebel. Then the third issue was that recognizing that language of the oppressor can be used to one's advantage. So outwitting the Americans on their English became a real thing for me. I learned to speak with the Boston drawl about packing the car, and I learned to speak like a Southerner, and I learned to speak like a Virginian and a West Coast person, because it is a way that I could retain my own language, but also use the language of the dominant culture. So this was very true at a time when Enrique Torres Trueba, who was a cultural anthropologist and my mentor, was fighting for the rights of bilingual education. Bilingual education had been actually acknowledged as a law in Massachusetts in 1968, but it was being thrashed around. It was constantly being a battleground for people who kept saying, in America, you only speak English. That is what America is about. So this began to help me navigate what would mean to be a Latina in the US context and especially in the academic world. So having this and having Giroux, I embraced Paulo Freire's ideas more than ever. And in fact, in doing my writing of my doctorate, I worked with teachers on their perspectives of how they were mediators of culture for children who often found themselves having to defend themselves with Spanish as a weapon against the police that would come to haunt them or to arrest them. So it was a very important moment in my life to use his power of language and thinking to benefit those I most cared about.
What were some of the concepts and ideas that you gained from being exposed to Paulo Freire's work?
Well, the first concept, which there are so many, 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 I mean, I really hope that whoever hears this podcast knows that you have to reread Freire and reread him, because there's a constant discovery of new words, new ideas, new ways of thinking. But the word that is, for me, very vital is his notion of conscientisation, which is the way he would pronounce it. He did not believe that you could say awareness raising. That wasn't sufficient. And even consciousness raising wasn't sufficient. That conscientisation really is about transitioning your knowledge from a very naive stage of awareness to a deeper stage of awareness until it becomes critical, because you now know the reasons underlying why that knowledge is either denied to you or suppressed. And in so doing, you basically look at any given situation, you try to decodify the situation, you then try to collect data so that you have a sense of what's going on and what's pertinent, and then you look at the concrete issues that surround it, some of which have to do with politics, cultural, economic issues. And then through reflection in a group, which is a cultural action group often, you begin to acquire an understanding and a deeper awareness of what it will take to create change. And that allows you then to come to the next word, which is praxis, which is reflection to action. And this can only take place when you have created room for dialogue, a critical understanding of the realities and how to overcome these. And praxis has been much of my vocabulary in the work that I've done at the university. The third, which is my favorite, is the sense of historicity, because Freire believed that we are all inserted in history, but just as we are subjects of history, we also create our own history. And it's this dialectical sense of history where the notion of understanding it is that we need to be critical of our lives to understand how history then begins to change and evolve. And one of my favorite phrases from him is the following: I do not live only in the past, rather I exist in the present, where I prepare myself for the possible. It was this sense of using historicity that then led me to think about dialogical process and the dialectical, because the understanding that we are subjects at one point and objects, that the interplay is between subject and object, means that there's a constant movement of knowledge between peoples, and that a teacher can at times be a subject because he or she is teaching and informing people and sharing information, but at the same time, a student can become that subject, and one becomes the object. And these are, this sense of dialectical, of movement, horizontal movement, was very enticing and very useful to my teaching. And the last phrase, which I always use in all of my classes, is the notion of problematization. Americans usually talk about problem solving, or the idea that to deal with a problem, you have to find a solution. I like his notion of problematization, which means to look at the deeper levels of what causes the conditions, the realities which give rise to that issue. So it's not so much a dialectical process, but what it presents is a problem that at one time has to be looked at from multiple perspectives. And you penetrate that problem by figuring out different ways to assess it, different ways to understand it. And it's not inseparable from the act of knowing, he said, but it's also inseparable from concrete situations. So you have to look at a given situation and basically deconstruct it in its entirety to know what it means. Those are, I think, powerful notions from him.
Well, I know you actually met Paulo Freire in the 80s. So why did you meet him? In what circumstances and for what reasons?
Well, in 1984, out of the 200 people that were actually looked at in terms of a post that was actually brought by Harvard Graduate School of Education looking for a community educator. I became, out of the four finalists, I became the person that was hired as the first full-time faculty Latina member in the area of teaching and learning at the Graduate School of Education at Harvard. And there, I taught courses in curriculum theory, teaching and learning, and later on, I began to gravitate more and more towards migration issues. But one of my first commitments while I was there was to try to have students know who Paulo Freire was, simply because I realized they did not know him, even though he had been at Harvard several years before, brought on by Noel McGinn and other people in the international education sector, but that people didn't really know of his work. So for the second semester, I was aided by a dear friend and colleague, Donaldo Macedo, who later became his interpreter. But Donaldo had graduated with me from Boston University, and we were able to bring Freire to Harvard. Please understand that at this time, Freire's name had gained ground in the United States because people like Stanley Aronowitz, Henry Giroux, Michael Apple, Peter McLaren, Ira Shore, Carlos Alberto Torres, Antonia Darner, and Michelle Klein had been writing with him, had been meeting him, had been visiting with him. And so he had bridged the Latin American learning that was going on to that of the United States, and particularly organizations and NGOs, which were very immersed, especially since their clientele was Latino or Latin American people. So these scholars were able to write about him, to manifest him in books, etc. I was a silent partner in the sense that I wanted to know this man, and it was Henry Giroux, then as a professor, Donaldo, who made that entry possible. So he was invited to Harvard, and it was wonderful that when he was invited, one of the first things he said is, I will come, but I want to make sure that the community organization groups are able to participate. When he said that, it was interesting that most of the students who put up the monies for his trip felt they owned him. They didn't want to share his time. So they had tensions in the question of how do we allocate time to students and also to the community. And when I spoke to Freire, he said he would only concede to have a short lecture with the students and the faculty on the pedagogy of the question, but the rest of the day would be spent with the community leaders. And true enough, what happened that day, there was a lot of negotiation, but it was possible that the morning sessions and the afternoon session was with the community leaders, and the evening session with a formal presentation to faculties and students was made on March 8, 1985.
And what were some of the outcomes of this presentation in 1985?
Well, what's marvelous about this presentation was that I gathered all of the notes that were recorded and actually all of the videotapes, of which I then reduced it to one single videotape of 1 hour, and all the anecdotes, remarks, statements were all gathered and put in, recorded in a way that I have them in my possession. And in fact, this podcast is the first podcast that shares some of those ideas that are not represented elsewhere. So in that sense, it's a very new idea, but we had well over 60 people attending in the morning with a waiting list of 20 more. People were fighting to get in because they wanted to be part of it. And Freire frowned upon my use of the word facilitator. He said, no, Marta, they are not facilitators. They are educators. And he corrected me on the spot. There were so many questions that arose from that meeting because they would actually do the questions, write the questions, prioritize the questions, then select the two or three that were most salient in their minds that they wanted. Some dealt with the lack of finances for their community organizations. Others talked about power dynamics. Others talked about the dynamics of how to deal with the outside world from their communities. But what he said is especially important. And here I'm quoting him directly. Education is not a tool, but transformation cannot be achieved without education. It is dialectical, it is contradictory, and if it is like this, we have to think about the process of liberation in global and political dimensions and try to discover that the role of education in this global political process, which we are calling a liberating process. The other idea that sticks with me from that session is systematic education in its nature reproduces the dominant ideology. It does not exhaust the role of education in society because there's another task to be accomplished by the educators inside this institutional space. And this other task is precisely demystifying the process of reproducing the dominant ideology. His other words, which to me are very true to this day, is that he said, if we are too worried with co-optation, we stop doing things. And this is the best way to be co-optive. So it was incredible how his words would carry so much weight. And his other statement, which I quote, is there is no such thing as neutral education. Many people in the States think that education is neutral, but it is not neutral in Nicaragua. It is not neutral in Costa Rica. It is not neutral in the Netherlands. It is not neutral, and I'm adding that, it is not neutral in Spain. And it is not neutral here. The question is to know in favor of what does non-neutrality work. The problem of manipulation directness is that education is not being neutral, is always by its nature the quality of being directive. I mean, his language was at times complex, but the meaning was so powerful. And the last one that I took from his notes was the arrogance of the intellectuals leads the intellectuals to say that the popular, meaning the people, cannot make abstractions and we need to get the message of the people. In other words, we do a lot to distance ourselves from the very people which we need to hear from. So in that evening, what he did was he continued to talk about dialogical messages, but I think the things that stand out, he kept talking about teachers need to create in themselves the need to understand that science is important, but science is a creation of human beings, and it has something inside which is historicity, and knowledge comes out because other knowledge becomes old, and it cannot explain the facts. So this continuous looking beyond that knowledge is not stagnant, but constantly changing. And the words that stick to me from him are, all known knowledge has the humility in coming up to bring it its hand, a testament and a will for the next one. The new knowledge comes up waiting for the next one to overcome it, to increase curiosity in the students. The humbler students are in this process, the more they will learn. And I've learned from my classes, it is true. When I see humble students, they've begun to really learn. And finally, he talks about there is no such thing as a stupid question. All questions are good ones, and all questions need to be answered. Something that I say to students when they often said, hey, maestra, that was a stupid question that I said, and I'll say no. So the issue about his teaching us is that in becoming curious, we create conditions in history that give us the continuity to become curious. And when we become curious, the one thing we need to be defended against is bureaucratization, because bureaucratization, as he said, is experiencing curiosity in a primal world. And finally, I think when he referred to migrants, he said, it's not enough to think of the migrant as a migrant, because we don't know what their lives are, but we must speak of their language, their culture, but more importantly, of their social class and their values. So for me, the issues that he presented that day stayed with me for a long, long time, and they continue to be. I was labeled immediately after the presentation of Freire as a radical professor. I was questioned even by the dean about my ideological stance on his democratic socialism. And I often was asked if I considered myself to be a communist. So I realized how little students knew of Freire and how much they needed to have their own ideological development grow. So until the last day of my tenure at Harvard as an associate professor, because after that I went to the University of Massachusetts in Boston, the label stuck with me. And on many occasions, my ideological thinking has continued from then on to be challenged.
Wonderful. I know you also wrote a review of his politics in education in 1985. So why did you write this review? How come?
Well, having met Paulo Freire, I was invited by the Harvard Ed Review to do a review of his latest book, which was The Politics of Education, which actually had a introduction by Henry Giroux and a last chapter of an interview between Donaldo Macedo and Freire. And Donaldo encouraged me to do it. And I received from Freire a box filled with all of his undated manuscripts, some of them with his signature, some of them with notes on the margins, which were wonderful. I wish I had that box today, because many of them were lost when I moved. But what was important of the book is he had some earlier chapters that he had already published, and then he had some new chapters that he added. And the earlier chapters catapulted me back to Latin America, to the discourses of social injustices. But the new chapters were about the organizational enclaves in the US, what it meant to work with Latinos and the academic system, the introduction of a stronger sense of critical pedagogy. And in that sense, I felt it was important because in the interview, Freire reflects on what it means for him to come into America and to bring his ideas into America and to also be criticized, and especially by the feminists. The American feminists went after Freire very strongly because of his use of the word man in his writing, and they felt that he had to be aware of gender issues, which he did take to heart because he later on kept writing between the he and she, but he expressed the difficulty of knowing who he was and how humble he was, but he had incorporated women into his thinking. The book is very elliptical. It goes back and forth, but it ends up with his story at the end. And I love the fact that he says during the time that he was writing this book, it is, he said, my way of writing about what I think and is thinking about what I do. And that's exactly what Freire is. You have to get into his mindset and his way of thinking, which is not easy. But once you do, you discover this incredible world of contrast. For example, in the book, he juxtaposes domination with oppression. He takes domestication with liberation, dehumanization with humanistic education, banking education, which is depository education of children, with liberating education. And he takes denunciation with annunciation. So this tension allows for the book to really engage you. And his favorite comment and thought for all of us to reflect on, which he did in the act of reading in 1983, is that he said, by reading the world always precedes reading the word. And reading the word implies continually reading the world. And in that sense, I think what he taught all of us through this book is the reinvention of power. That one can reinvent power in counter-hegemonic ways by critically questioning reality. And this is the revitalization of language that he has, of utopianism and of revolution, and an emancipatory process that is brought about by critique. I think, as he says, we need to make history only when we are continually critical of our lives.
What happened after the review and into the 90s? How did you maintain your interest in his teachings in the 90s and afterwards?
Well, I made sure that all of my courses had some permutations of Freire. And in the 90s, I became part of a planning board for a major US organization that was one of the oldest in the country, made up of administrators and teachers. And they were in the need of what we now see today, that there were simply too many white people in the organizational management, and there was a need to do outreach to other ethnic groups in order for representation to take place. Since I considered Paulo Freire to be a top drawing presenter, I suggested him as part of this board. So the board invited him to come to the conference in April of 1996. Because I spoke some Spanish, I speak Spanish and Portuguese, I was the contact person with Maestro Freire, and we called each other on a weekly basis to plan what they expected and he could deliver. The more we talked, the more it was clear that the expectations that were laid out by the board were not those shared by Freire. The board had requested that Freire write down the objectives of his presentation on curriculum and on supervision and the development of it, while Freire insisted he wanted to create a conversation. As he said, eu quero conversar. That was the way he said it. So dialogue, of course, was untenable with 600 people in attendance. So the organization said, no, 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 we need buzzwords to target our advertisers. This is a marketing plan. We have to get it going. So Freire said, Marta, you deal with them. I cannot deal with them. You write what you think Americans want to hear. And that's in fact what I did. I wrote down the objectives for this presentation, the results will be da-da, and I played the game the way I knew it had to be played. And when he was there, he arrived with his wife, Nita Freire. The first thing he said, can you tell me how to figure out how to get a message out of the telephone in his room? So I spent 20 minutes trying to figure out what button to push, and I taught him how it worked. And he laughed and said to me, look at this. Look how machinery conditions our communication. And we laughed about it and then went out to dinner that evening, for which there is a picture of myself with him somewhere that I will share with you. And in that picture, it was interesting that the next morning, when I arrived at the hall, there was a very small bearded man surrounded by video camera screens on both sides, enormous, with a podium, with all kinds of machinery. And he was diminished by the conglomeration of all this technological machinery. He paused before he began his presentation, and he told them point blank, I am not going to speak about supervision and curriculum. And he was not going to give them the 3 or 4 points that they wanted, but he was going to have a dialogue, a conversation with them. And he wanted to create that space, even with the 600 people that were there. And he said, I cannot begin to speak of curriculum or supervision without addressing teachers and their dreams. He said, unless a teacher reaches his or her students, there would be no curriculum because it would not connect with the reality of their lives. So as he spoke, some people were moving their heads. They were agreeing with him. But then some people started to stream out, leaving the rooms. And a couple of them said, shouldn't he be speaking good English? Those who stayed gave way to Freire, gave him several ovations at the end. And then during the book signing, which was 2 blocks long in size, I helped with the translations. One teacher particularly stopped, and as Freire was signing his book for her, she had tears running down, and she said to him, which I recorded, it was your teachings and readings that helped me to have hope and survive as I witnessed my students being slaughtered during the Rwandan genocide while I tried to hide them. And this was a myriad of accolades from people. That evening when we went out to dinner with the board members, he shared some of his personal studies. And when I asked him what was better in the power struggles that one might have, should I be in the firing line or in the center? Because I was always feeling I was in opposite to the academic sense, he replied, Marta, you can do much more inside than outside of the power domain, because remember, it's a structure, it's a pyramid, and you can create, like a mouse creates spaces by eating the cheese, you can create spaces where eventually it collapses. And that kind of thinking has always stayed with me on power dimensions and power relationships. Those were the last words that I heard from him at that time. Next morning, we said goodbye, and I knew I would not see him again. And when I received the announcement of his passing away on May 2nd, 1997, which was shared throughout all the websites of the world, I simply broke down and cried. At the next board meeting, Freda's talk was discussed by the group, and to my chagrin, they kept saying, he just didn't speak English well. And he said, and it was hard for people to understand him, although his name was very well known. And some of his statements were too obtuse. The president of the board then simply said, having brought him from Brazil was not cost effective because he was not enough of a drawing crowd pleaser. Sadly, this was an unexpected blow to the effort of bringing new voices in, but it signaled very clearly the economic capitalism that Freire opposed. The silencing of his message left me stunned. And a follow-up newsletter, which was printed in May of the conference, showed Freire's picture and written statements, and this was captured from his presentation. And I quote from him, I can't respect the teacher who doesn't dream of a certain kind of society that he would like to live in and would like the new generation to live in. Educators should pursue a dream of society less ugly than those we have today. A society that is more open and less marred by prejudice. My dreams and the dreams of students should have a strong role in shaping the curriculum, he asserted. I have to put my understanding of curriculum to the service of this dream. After this, I left the board.
After Freire's death, how have you woven his ideas into your own teachings and research?
Well, one of the things that has impressed me about his teaching is how consolidated his thinking becomes over time. And I've often seen myself reverting to his statements. And obviously, it's reflected in my coursework. First of all, I believe students to need liberatory thinking, not banking education, but education that liberates their own thinking and allows them to question. And his pedagogy of the question, he often said, why do you think teachers ask questions and answer them themselves? And it took me a long time to realize it's because teachers don't want to often wait to hear what the answers may be from students. So I've learned to listen very carefully to what he taught me. And when I think about it, my first learning from him occurred at Harvard when I was teaching there, which is one of the 13 universities I've taught in. And I was teaching a course on transfer of curriculum, which meant the transfer of global North ideas on curriculum to global South countries. And it was about what can we learn from mastery learning from the US, or what can we learn from X learning, but rarely what can we learn from the South that might affect the global North. And in this course, I had obtained a book. It was international students along with American students, 14 of them. And the day I started the class with my graduate assistant, Cynthia Gray, I remember how strongly they said, Maestra, you've been teaching us about Freire. How dare you give us a book? They burnt the book and they decided, no, we've decided that this class, which is about thinking and knowledge and transference of knowledge, should be basically by using reflective letters. We want to create this course around the letters we write each other each week and to discuss our thinking and to bring to the fore issues and concerns we have about education. Mm-hmm. And that's what became our course. I have all of those letters, which I hope to write into an article or a reflective piece, but it's wonderful that in our criticism and our reflectiveness, we were able to capture the things that we felt needed to be learned and those that were really oppressive and contaminated the learning of people as though they couldn't learn on their own. Then later on, obviously at UMass Boston, I did an enormous amount to get people out into the communities because I also realized that how can you talk about urban education if you don't, if you're not in the urban centers where it takes place? So I had my students actually go, since they were administrators and they were educators during the day, and they took the courses at night with me, I had them go on Saturdays with me into the communities, meet the people, create ethnographies of their lives, understand the processes of schooling through their eyes, and did a lot of work in that area. And that was very, very satisfying for me. While I was teaching at UMass, Freire was invited two or three times by other departments, and especially Donaldo would have him come over for 2-3 weeks, but he would go to Amherst as well. So Freire was continually teaching in different places, but I didn't have the opportunity to meet up with him again during that time. So one of the things that I then have brought to Europe has been a lot of his teaching at UvA and especially AUC, Amsterdam University College, where I've been teaching for the last 10, almost 11 years now. And in doing this, one of the things I've learned in migration, ethnographic research, global leadership, and social systems is to push my students in Freirean ways. They have to respect the communities they research. They have to gain friendships and learn from community leaders such as Mohamed Jaouna, who is with Changemakers here in Amsterdam. They need to understand that it is the community people who are giving their best knowledge to them, and that it is a co-construction of knowledge that counts here, that it is the dialogues and the reinventions that capture their stories as a symbol of really genuine ethnographic work. And in so doing, the students have also learned about community ethnographies, that they don't create the questions ahead of time. They work with the community to come up with the questions that they have as burning issues that need to have research gathered in order for them to answer those and to put them into practice. Last week, I received a note from one of my former students who's pursuing a double master's at UvA. And he said to me, which was very, very pleasant, "I have recently been rereading Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed, and there is just so much of his method that shines through our classes, your classes. I did not realize this at the time, but I'm extremely appreciative of the way in which I learned to conduct sociological research under your supervision." These are the kinds of echoes of Paulo Freire's voice that have really affected me over life. And personally, I think his remarks or statements, he would always make side comments like, "What do I need to do to get my son into Harvard?" he would comment. Or he would say, "Marta, can we get some food that doesn't taste like paper, some real churrasco, some comida latina?" These are his statements that have stayed with me. And they are like the consejos that my mother would give to me when she was alive. At times, it seems to me that at times his thinking about the sense of silence helps my spirit. There are times when I feel I remember his words echoing. "I can speak a lot in silence. I can say lots of things silently." It is this wonderful juxtaposition of words that makes his speech so powerful. He taught me to deconstruct the intensely political nature of academic institutions and their constituents. And he showed me how naive I was when I started academic life. And now how politically savvy I've become as a consequence of that. But he also taught me about humility in teaching how little I really know when I know, because I've just uncovered the tip of the iceberg. And he taught me that the ethics of treating people as myself are lessons for life. His statement about, and I quote, "We cannot overestimate the power of education. we must recognize the limits we have as educators is a reminder of his intercultural understanding of education, because he believed and engaged with others while being aware of possibilities. If he were alive today, he would be a standard for what's going on in this crazy world we're living in of uncertainties, and he would manifest his ideas in a very prudent way. So his legacy, which is, I think, the next question that you have for me.
Yeah, I was about to ask, what do you consider to be the legacy of his work in education and critical pedagogy?
Well, I think he's taught us a lesson about the complexity of education and our roles as educators and intellectuals. I like the fact that he always saw teachers as people capable of creating new theories and new thoughts. And the critical pedagogy that he talks to us about is for action, for confronting the reality of not staying silent, of not staying mute, but of really deeply thinking and offering solutions that are really communitarian and are based on the needs of people. Moreover, I think that for me, when he talked about silence, that is a lesson to be learned, because silence, he said, is imposed on us, not by the other, but by concrete situations we're in. We have silence through which, inside of which, we communicate among ourselves. That means that silence cannot be understood bureaucratically. That kind of thinking makes us aware of how much we need to break, as he often said, out of our silence, and to be able to talk in ways that engage others into dialogue and then practice. I can spend 1 hour silent, but absolutely alive, creatively silent or silently creative. And to me, it really epitomizes much of his teaching, a quietness with a powerful outcome. He often said that we needed tension. I used to become very upset when I saw conflict in my students or conflict in my teaching. But he said, we really need to incarnate those tensions. The first one is, how do I do with my voice and the silence of the students? How do I deal with the voice of the students and my necessary silence? If we do not deal with our tension, our tendency is not to break down the tension if it were possible. So it's, how do I break down the tensions that I often find by not having the answers? And what I've learned from this is that we need to deconstruct what the tension is about to understand that the answers are already to be found from the very discussion of those issues. So for me, I think that what he's taught me is not simply what occurs in education, but what occurs in human life, in being as humble as he was, a social democratic educator, a believer of people. And I think those are the thoughts that will remain with me until the day I'm no longer here.
What kind of hope do you believe Paulo Freire offers us today, especially during these times of uncertainty, but also quite strong political swings to the right?
I think it is time that we revisit Paulo Freire and we reinvent his words and reinvent his hope. His book on pedagogy of hope is more needed now than ever. And his sense of love, which has been written about, is what we need as a vision making for the intercultural world that we should be seeing, even in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic and in the midst of so much racial destabilization, conflict, etc. I think that it is time that we take from his pedagogy of hope the fact that he said to us, and with this I would conclude, there is no change without a dream, as there is no dream without hope. I think for all of us, hope is the driving force for the future and for generations to come. Gracias.
Thank you, Maestra. I think it's a beautiful way to conclude. And thank you so much again to be doing this with me. And it was wonderful to learn about you and Paulo Freire and how it influenced your life. So thank you.
Thank you, Domitiana. Likewise, it's been a wonderful journey.
Thank you to our listeners for tuning in. And now we would like to ask you, what do you learn from this episode that you did not know before? What ideas resonated with you? What do you take away for your personal development? From having heard this episode, how do Freire's teachings intersect with intercultural education? Let us know by writing us a review or sending us an email to info@iaie.org.